You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, and Mia Magus is about to speak about the magnificence of community care. So we'll be coming to you live over the next hour. And for more information, you can check out theeverybodyconference.wordpress.com.
Mia, who is with us here today, thank you for coming.
Probably know who she is already, but
it feels like we have to do this. So, Mia, oh my god, Mia, you have a really good blog. Can I tell you that? We read it all the time. Mia's an amazing writer who talks about a lot of different things, from disability justice to queerness and things like femininity, transnational, transracial adoption, and critical race theory, all sorts of things about your experiences and people's other experiences, really taking it into consideration in our work. And I think that's so important. I think a lot of people are doing that, but I really want to encourage that. I'm really glad that you do that. I mean, okay, well, Mia is also from the Bay Area and does work with Generation 5 and the Bay Area Transformative Justice Collaborative. And you do all sorts of other amazing things. I don't really know. I had an intro, but I just don't even feel like reading it.
Yeah.
Is that okay? Yeah, we're good? Okay. Do you want to just talk?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. It was the best introduction ever. Thank you. Hi, everyone. Is it just... yes, I know it's the longest name ever, but I am a member, a really proud member of the Bay Area Transformative Justice Collaborative, and I was a staff member at Gen 5, and the BATJC, the Bay Area Transformative Justice Collaborative, we are working to build a local collective of folks working to build transformative justice responses to child sexual abuse. So that's like where my heart is right now. And disability justice, but I'm not really here to talk to you all about that, even though I could talk to you all about that forever. Good afternoon, Canada. This is my first time being in Canada. I really love it, by the way. Everybody here has been so nice to me, like in surprising ways. People, just random strangers, so nice. I can't even believe it. So I want to start out today with... First, I want to thank you all for having me here. And for those of you all who don't know, I met Shabina in a Gen 5 3-day workshop, training. And now I'm like speaking at the conference you organized. So amazing. But yeah, it takes a lot of work. It's not just you two, I know, but it takes a lot of work to put things like this on and a lot of time and energy and just, you know, just like they were talking about sleepless nights and everything. So just to really appreciate you all's work so that we can come together and be together in this space, because it's no small thing. And I want to also thank, as always, thank all the people who made it possible for us to be here today. The folks, including the folks who built this building and who clean and care for it every day, including the people who are being violently exploited around the globe and in this country for their resources so that we can sit here in this air-conditioned room in, you know, relative safety from, like, military attacks or the police barging in, because we know that that's not true everywhere around the world either. And so just want to give a lot of gratitude and honor, really, to being able to have access to clean water and food and air. And last but not least, which I have... In all the spaces I've been in today, or since I've been in Canada, Toronto and Guelph, paying honor to First Nations folks, not just here in Canada, but around the globe, and like really bringing in their struggles, a collective struggle that has to be part of our work, because that colonization and genocide has also allowed for us to be here. Hi. So I want to begin our time, as always, with a little bit of grounding. So whatever you all are doing right now, in whatever way that it makes you feel comfortable to move your body, to feel a little bit more connected to it and a little bit more connected to the earth and the planet and each other. So whether that's, for some of you, it might be putting your feet on the ground. For some of you, it might be closing your eyes. For some of you, it might be turning off your phone and putting it to the side. But whatever that is, just to take a moment to ground and just take a second to breathe and to breathe deeply and really let your diaphragm expand and let your lungs expand and take a moment to feel your lungs and your rib cage as they expand as you breathe in. And just want to take a moment to feel your body and to remember that it's there. I think one of the important things that disability justice does is it brings our bodies back into the conversation and to remember that some of us don't have the luxury of not being able to be in our bodies or not being able to be aware constantly of our bodies. And so also this framing in our movements of like, we have to get back into our bodies, to really understand that as a very ableist and like able-bodied centered way of being. And so to just take a moment, right, to remember our bodies and to give thanks and honor for all of the work that they're doing right now. You know, and not only because our bodies are oftentimes the sites of so much violence and trauma, like it makes so much sense, right? It's really intelligent and smart that we may not be in our bodies, right? And so we don't want to lose that. And I just want to invite whatever it is for you that lets you just drop in a little bit more. Whether it's a millimeter, whether it's an inch, whether it's a foot, whatever that is for you. And it might be breathing just a little bit deeper, right? Checking in with the tops of your feet, your toes, your organs, digesting your food maybe from lunch, that delicious food from lunch. Feeling your chest, right? Like really feeling into your shoulders and all the tendons and muscles in there. And I want to say that as much as possible, we need to keep bringing in our bodies in a more holistic way of doing this work, because the work of liberation, if we take it on, the work for all of us and not just some of us, it's not easy work, right? And I think, like I said, for those of us who commit to it, it's some of the most hardest and challenging work that we'll ever do. And we forget that it impacts our bodies and our spirits and our hearts and our minds. I mean, we talk in very heady ways about like colonization or occupation or gentrification or whatever, white supremacy, male supremacy. But oftentimes we do it in a way that's not fully connecting and realizing the wear and tear that actually has on us. And, you know, we forget the impact that it has to hold the large levels of sexual violence that are being waged on, for example, children of color here and around the globe, right? So again, I want to just invite you to breathe deeply, and I want to invite you to remember to breathe during this talk, to remember to feel your body as I talk, because there's so much knowledge and wisdom there. And as you're finishing up your grounding, I really want you to remember why you do this work. Why are you here? What is it that brings you here into this room, to this conference? What is it that keeps bringing you back, that keeps allowing you to show up for the movement, to show up for each other? What is that? What is it that gets you up out of bed every morning, that keeps you going? Why are you doing this work? This work for liberation. And I want us to think about the communities that your work is in service of and really hold them in your mind. Feel them. What are your wishes and your dreams for them? Because this work is not just about us, like me, myself, and I, right? We're doing this in service of something larger. And taking another deep breath in and remembering to breathe. Just remembering why we do this work and holding that at the forefront. It's a place of resiliency for us, but it's also one of the things that will help keep us honest in this work and will help keep us responsible. So let us ground in and honor all of the folks who have come before us, the people who have done movements and been active in movements, the communities, the freedom fighters, the revolutionary, the earth. Let us honor all the people who have made our lives possible. Whether we know their names or not, whether we like them or not, whether there are hard things between us and them or not. Let us hold the complexities and contradictions of the lessons learned and the mistakes made by those who have come before us, because it wasn't all great. And just because people are our elders doesn't mean that they're not complicated people. Let's hold the complexities and contradictions of the care and the harm of many of our previous movements and communities. Let's hold and honor the humanness of the folks who have come before us. and holding and honoring and just grounding in everyone who has come before us, who has wanted something more than criminalization, isolation, self-hate, trauma, and shame. And next, let's ground in and honor all of us here today, all of the people who are doing work at our sides, with us and for us, who are alive today and fighting. For all the people fighting for liberation in this country and around the globe in big and small ways, whether, you know, they're working for environmental justice, for racial justice, for First Nation and Indigenous liberation, for prison abolition, disability justice, people who are raising children in magical and liberatory ways, the healers, the radical educators, the gardeners. We honor them here with us today. And especially the community builders and caretakers whose work oftentimes goes unseen and valued, but we know it's the foundation of any large-scale change that we will want to make. And last but not least, let us ground in and honor those yet to come, the people that we do this work for. We vow to be able to pass on concrete and sustainable tools to them. And we wish for them a deep sense of belonging and dignity and pride and home. They help keep our feet close to the fire and help keep our work honest and accountable. They remind us to be aware of the luxury of time in such harsh global conditions. Our work and our time is responsible to them, and we work so that they may have a lighter burden to carry. So let's take one more deep breath in, collectively. Thank you all. That's it. No, I'm just kidding. I'm really honored to be here, and I'm always honored to be part of any type of liberation work that's being done. I really take it seriously, the time that we have together. I know we don't have a lot of time, and I wish I could, like, have individual three-hour conversations with each and every one of you, but I can't. But, you know, I think about this work as being soul work. You know, it's not just how do we wage this campaign or, you know, change this policy or how do we make this access happen or what have you. But it's really so deeply connected to my spirit and my heart for me. And, you know, I think about it for me as a kind of spirituality in and of itself, to be connected to something larger than ourselves, to be working for the values of community, care, and interdependency. I mean, how amazing is that? To be working for a just world. I mean, for me, there is nothing closer to the meaning of love. So I really am honored to be here with you all. Thank you for asking me to come. So I do this work in service of community, and I've said this other places, and maybe some of you are familiar with me saying this, but I tell my story with the knowing that all of our stories are tools for liberation. I speak knowing that all of our voices are important. I speak to leave evidence for people like me who are searching for reflection and recognition and a yes, we exist. I speak to leave evidence for folks who have been told that disability is not as important as race or that gender justice will have to wait until after class equality is won. For folks who have been told that how you feel is less important than what you think. For those who don't have the luxury of being able to rattle off 10, even 5 writers or books that reflect their identities or experiences. For those of us who straddle the lines between multiple oppressed communities. For those of us who are working to end violence for all of us, not just some of us. And for those of us who truly believe that no one's safety is more important than anyone else's, even when we feel unsafe. Hopefully all of us here know that we have a responsibility to end oppression and cycles of violence, yes? Yes, that is part of our responsibility as people being on the planet. Hopefully we know that our lives are not separate from the people gathered here, each and every one of you. The folks who cook and grow our food, the people who made our clothing that we're wearing right now, the folks who assembled our computers and our phones, as well as the people who maintain these grounds. So I want to specifically name my privilege as a disabled person in being here, speaking with you here today, especially when so many of us are locked up in prisons, institutions, psychiatric wards, group homes, or literally chained to the beds in the back rooms of our parents' houses. Yes, I'm oppressed by ableism, most definitely, as a disabled person, and I also benefit from it. And it is important for me to name that. It's important for us to talk about the complexities of our identities and experiences, especially how we can be both oppressed and privileged by the same identity. I have a level of mobility that many disabled folks don't have, and I know it's a huge reason why I'm able to be so visible. As someone who is physically disabled and doesn't have, for example, mental or cognitive disabilities, I know how privileged it is to get to speak from a microphone to a crowd and a room full of people to be listened to. I want to acknowledge that many of us here are survivors of one form of violence or another. Many of us have been witness to violence. Many of us have been violent, caused harm, or colluded in violence, whether it was willingly or not, whether we knew it or not. I mean, all of our tax dollars go somewhere, right? And all of us have been implicated by a culture of relentless violence. So I would like to acknowledge that we carry legacies of sexual abuse, trauma, and violence with us every day into our work, into our relationships, and here today. Our stories about gender and race and class and ability and size and immigration and family, they're carried in our bodies, our breath, and our spirit. Our experiences with violence and oppression are never separate from us, and they inform our work and relationships, and we cannot forget this. And we have to build spaces that can hold that as we do this work. And I also want to acknowledge and remind us that we bring legacies of resistance and survival and love in the face of silence and erasure that carry us through. We bring those into this room as well, and they are also with us all of the time that we can draw on at any time. We bring joy. We bring our joy with us. We bring legacies of resiliency that are deep and strong and which we are a part of. And I think in all of our work, it's our responsibility to grow and cultivate resiliency. Just as much as we resist the current systems at work, we must not only fight against the world that we currently have, but also be working to create the world that we want, right? To create the world that we dream and long for, the kind of world that's inspired by our deepest desires for ourselves and our families, whomever they may be, including chosen family, situational family, what have you. But it is from this place, the world that we desire and long for, that I would like us to always start our work, from the world that we collectively long for. So I want everyone to just take a moment. You can close your eyes. You can just find a place to stare at. You can look at down at your desk, whatever it is. You just take a moment, and I want you to envision the world that you want. Our work is done. We've reached justice and liberation, right? What does that world look like? What do you envision? Maybe you can't envision something. How do you feel? What lives there when you think about it, when you feel into it? For some of us, it might be, what do we remember? Oftentimes, this can be a hard place to start from. I want to acknowledge that. I find that we are far more skilled in knowing what we don't want, far more skilled at resisting than we are at knowing what we do want and being able to articulate that and envision it, right? We know what we're against and what we will not tolerate, but when asked what we are for and to describe our visions and our dreams, it's so much harder. Maybe, and I, you know, for many of you, some of you might have been very easy. I think you should share with all of us, please. You know we want liberation, but what does that really mean? What does it look like? How will we know when we're there? So, you know, we do away with capitalism and male supremacy, but then what? Who will clean the toilets? Who will cook the food? Take out the trash? How will all the children get fed? We have to think about these things. And what will it look like to get to liberation? What does that process look like? Because in my work building transformative justice responses to violence, I ask myself that daily. What will our strategies and communities need to look like on the way to transformative justice? Because they will be different. And it's so important to remember that. And it's so important to remember that those strategies, while they will be different, they are for the same larger purpose, right? And that's what's important. We can use all kinds of different strategies of figuring out how to funnel money from fucked up places to do amazing work, right? But that it's all moving towards the same place, right? That we're all working together for the same collective shared vision. So I want us to practice dreaming and visioning a future more. Like, really practice it. Like, do it every day for 2 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever that is for you. I want us to get good at it and become familiar with it. And for many of us, right, like I said, it might be about remembering and revealing where glimmers of liberation already exist or existed in our lives. I believe that a shared collective vision is a source of resiliency for us that we can draw on and that will keep us focused and fueled in this work. Okay. This is such a precarious thing to drink out of. Do you have, like, a cup? Yeah, it's okay. Can I use it?
Yeah, sure. Oh.
It's okay. Right? I mean, is it? Okay. Yes. Community. Okay. So the theme of this conference, right, is about collective care, yes? Mm-hmm. How is it going? You all enjoying it?
Yeah.
Yes. So I want to focus my remarks today on what it means to take care of each other. And because really, I think care is at the crux of so much of our work. When people ask me, like, what is transformative justice responses to child sex abuse? I'm like, you know, really at its crux, we're talking about how do we take care of each other better, right? We know that prisons, white supremacy, gentrification, you know, transphobia, ableism, we know that they're not taking care of us, right? And so at its most basic, I think a lot of our work is reimagining and relearning and remembering what it means to take care of each other and what that actually looks like and what that work will be. Whatever work you do, whatever your entryway into that kind of central piece of taking care of each other is, but maybe it's to focus on elders. Maybe it's to focus on mamas who have, you know, single mamas with children, whatever it is, right? How do we take care of each other? We know that collective care is something we want, but what does it actually mean, and how can we make sure that we're not leaving our folks behind? Because when I think about collective care, I think about disabled bodies almost immediately. How do we have collective care that can care for disabled people? Because it's not just the institutions that are harming disabled folks. It's also our very communities and our families, the very people who are supposed to take care of us and protect us. How do we have collective care that can really care for disabled people? That is not based on an able-bodied normative standard, but that also invites everyone to contribute. So often, disabled folks are the last to get cared for, and our care is devalued, dangerous, and/or harmful. I think one of the most powerful things that disability has to offer our movements is a challenge around how we integrate and value access and care in our work and liberation. Our bodies signal need, and they're uncontrollable in amazing, marvelous ways. They are reminders of mortality and isolation. We talk about the importance of making our movements and communities accessible, and yes, that's important. We have to make our work and our spaces more accessible. There's no way around it, right? Access is concrete resistance to the very real daily isolation that disabled people face. That's real. And we're never going to be able to get around that. Any type of work that we want to do with disabled communities or around disabled communities is going to involve access. But I don't want us to just make things accessible. I want us to build a political container in which that access can take place and be grounded in. Access for the sake of access is not necessarily liberatory, right? As Grace Lee Boggs talks about, access to the burning house is not necessarily liberatory, right? So what, we want disabled people to have access to the same shitty jobs that we all have so that now they can get sexually harassed on the job or now they can make under minimum wage? Right? Like, that's not what we want. And sometimes access gets framed like that, right? Like, oh, access is what's important. No, I think it's actually a tool to be leveraged, to use, to challenge able-bodied supremacy, a tool for disability justice, a tool to transform the conditions which even allowed that inaccessibility to happen in the first place, right? That's what we want. I believe that we can do access in liberatory ways that aren't just about inclusion, diversity, and equality, but are rather in service of justice, liberation, and interdependency. Access should be happening in service of our larger goal of building interdependency and embracing need, especially in a culture that tells us that we should not need ever. Because this is such a deep part of challenging ableism and the myth of independence. Have people heard of the myth of independence here? Some of you? So the myth of independence, of course, being that everybody can and should be able to do everything on their own, right? And of course, we know that that's not true. Someone made the clothes you're wearing right now. They made the shoes that you have on. They made your car, the mass transit system maybe, or the bike that you use. We don't grow all our own food and spices, right? We are interdependent and dependent on other people. We are dependent on each other, and there's no way around that. None of us are going to be able to survive just on our own forever and ever and ever. I mean, maybe some of us will, but that's pretty amazing. The myth of independence reflects such a deep level of privilege, especially in this rugged, individualistic, capitalist society. The very idea, right, that we could even mildly conceive of our lives and our accomplishments as solely our own. And of course, the other side of this is not just that it's not true, right? It's not just that the myth of independence is not true in terms of, like, I'm not independent by myself and everything that I do. So it's not just that it's not true. It's not just that the emperor has no clothes, but that everyone else should pretend that he's fully clothed too. That's part of the myth as well. So the myth of independence is not just about the truth of being connected and interdependent on one another. It's also about the high value that gets placed on buying into the myth and believing that you are independent. The high value placed on even striving to be independent, right? That's part of the myth of independency too. That's part of what we're fighting against. So we don't want to, like, pretend to do interdependency as we're also striving to still be independent, right? We want to fight all of those pieces of the myth of independency. Is that making sense to folks? Yeah. How can we talk about collective care without talking about interdependence and the myth of independence? Indeed, the very idea of collective care reveals that the myth of independence is just that. It is a myth because we want to strive for something different. Interdependence moves us away from the myth of independence and towards relationships where we're all valued and we all have things to offer. It moves us away from knowing disability only through dependency, right, which paints disabled bodies as being a burden on others, at the mercy of able-bodied people's benevolence. We become charity cases, a way for able-bodied people to feel better about themselves, and we internalize our sense of being a burden, sad, and tragic. And all of this sets up a dynamic where disabled people feel like we have to be liked in order to receive the basic daily access that we need to live. And where able-bodied people feel entitled to praise and recognition for providing access, what I like to call being a decent human being. This dynamic of disabled people being dependent on able-bodied people shapes so many disabled people's lives that I know, including my own, and of course is the foundation upon which so much domination, power, and control and violence happens, right? Like, I'm not going to help you go to the bathroom unless you do what I say or unless you make me feel good. I believe that interdependency is a strategy for liberation for all of us, not just disabled people. Because we're not the first community to be talking about interdependency. Poor communities have been doing it, communities of color, immigrant communities, right? Queer communities have a long history of what interdependency actually looks like. And I think if we're really committed to valuing interdependency and practicing it, it has the power to be transformative for our relationships, our communities, and our movements. Because the truth is that we need each other. We need each other. Because any type of large-scale change that we want to make is going to require that we work together to do it. We're not going to be able to do it alone. We've tried that, and it hasn't worked. Even just four or five of us are not going to be able to do it alone, because we've tried that too, and it has not worked. So we need each other. And if we finally commit to that simple truth, it necessarily changes and shifts how we treat one another and how we treat ourselves. Right? Because we can't treat each other as though we're disposable anymore. We can't just, oh, I don't like you, so I'll just find new friends. It's great, right? But what does collective care mean for us? What does it truly mean to care for each other in this historical moment, when so many of us have so much trauma and generational trauma, and we are taught to fear everything and everyone, even love and intimacy? What does it mean to truly care for each other when the generational impacts of colonization, exploitation, violence, war, and slavery have become so established in our communities, cut so deep, that we have learned to use these tools against each other? What can collective and community care look like in these kind of conditions, when so many forces are working to destroy our communities and distract and divide our work? I want to dig deeper into conversations about community and collective care, to move just past and beyond just merely access, to get to some of the more difficult aspects of community and collective care, to go to the places that make us feel uncomfortable or afraid, to unflinchingly hold the things that will inevitably come up when we attempt to practice collective care, the things that often end our best efforts towards a beloved community, as Martin Luther King Jr. talks about. And to not just tolerate them or sit them out, but to actively desire them. I'm talking about shifting our desires from beauty and easy and me to ugly and magnificence and we. Queering our desires, right? I'm talking about changing what we find attractive and desirable. Desiring commitment, hard conversations, desiring the ugly, and not just people, but also communities. I'm talking about moving towards the ugly, disabling and queering our desires for collective care. What does it mean to desire the hard, the ugly, the messy, instead of the easy, the cute, and the clean? Because it's not easy. The work of learning how to love each other under these conditions, the work of cross-movement and cross-community building, and we are far from where we want to be. In a violent and oppressive world, the work of love is never done. It's hard, and we will want to give up. I guarantee it. We will want to run away, to isolate ourselves, to give in. We will get tired and burned out and be afraid to make mistakes, and even more ashamed when we do make mistakes. And when we are tired and triggered or hurt, we will want to fall back into familiar, comfortable, and easy solutions of good and bad people, of reaching for our old reliables like criminalization and punishment, superiority and stubbornness. And we will have to hold each other in all of this and commit to keep steadily and consistently bringing each other back to our values of liberation and our shared vision. Because all of us have had relationships in this room, yes, with people? Have they all gone perfectly? Right? We've all probably reached places in relationships with people that we love, with people that started out amazing, right? Infatuation and a kind of energy that you could live off of. You didn't need sleep. And I'm not just talking about romantic relationships. I'm talking about all kinds of love, right? And things got hard. Did we know how to work through it? And then we're talking about collective care. We're talking about expanding that to how do we love each other in a collective way? What does that look like? Because if we're going to practice collective care, those things are going to come up. It's not like we're just going to practice the logistics of collective care and be able to know A is B, and then B goes to C, and C goes to D, right? Because like I said, we're in this historical moment that we're living in, we all have so much generational trauma that we're carrying with each other, with us. So how can it not come up? We may have the skills to vision and even desire collective care, but the practice is a whole other set of skills, and more than anything, takes incredible commitment and faith. Like I said before, this is soul work. Because really, we are talking about challenging able-bodied supremacist desires, not just as they relate to our bodies and our minds, but as they relate to our relationships and communities. How will we ever be able to build relationships in which queer, disabled people of color could experience the love we need for liberation and the access we need to survive at the same time, instead of having to trade in one for the other? And when I talk about the ugly, I'm talking about those pieces in us that we hide or are told to be ashamed of. I gave a talk a couple years ago called Moving Towards the Ugly, and so I'm going to read a quote from that. because it just says it so well, rather than trying to restate it. And it was for the Femmes of Color Symposium in Oakland, California. So I was talking a lot about gender in it, but I think it's applicable here today. And in a lot of ways, I feel like this talk today picks up where that left off, to move us from just more of an individualized way of understanding ugly to a more collective way of understanding ugly. So this is the quote. As the generational effects of global capitalism, genocide, violence, oppression, and trauma settle into our bodies, we must build new understandings of bodies and gender that can reflect our histories and our resiliency, not our oppressor or our self-shame and loathing. We must shift from a politic of desirability and beauty to a politic of ugly and magnificence that moves us closer to bodies and movements that disrupt, dismantle, disturb. Bodies and movements ready to throw down and create a different way for all of us, not just some of us. The magnificence of a body that shakes, spills out, needs help, moseys, slinks, limps, drools, rocks, curls over onto itself. The magnificence of a body that doesn't get to choose when to go to the bathroom, let alone what bathroom to use. A body that doesn't get to choose what to wear in the morning or what hairstyle to sport, how they're going to move or stand or what time they're going to bed. The magnificence of bodies that have been coded as not just undesirable and ugly, but unhuman. The magnificence of bodies that are understanding gender in far more complex ways than I could explain here. Moving beyond a politic of desirability to loving the ugly. Respecting ugly for how it has shaped us and been exiled. Seeing its power and magic. Seeing the reasons it's been feared. Seeing it for what it is, some of our greatest strength. Because we all do it. We all run from the ugly. And the farther we run from it, the more we stigmatize it and the more power we give beauty. Our communities are obsessed with being beautiful and gorgeous and hot. What would it mean if we were ugly? What would it mean if we didn't run from our own ugliness and each other's? How do we take the sting out of ugly? What would it mean to acknowledge our ugliness for all it has given us, how it has shaped our brilliance and taught us about how we never want to make anyone else feel?
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, and this is a live broadcast of Mia Mingus, broadcasting from the Everybody's Conference, which is currently in progress. Strolling to Anatolia will be starting a little bit later today when the live broadcast finishes.
Stop chasing pretty. Stop sucking in and shrinking and spending enormous amounts of money and time on things that don't make us magnificent. Where is the ugly in you? What is it trying to teach you? And I'm not saying that it's easy to be ugly without apology. It's hard as fuck. It threatens our survival. I recognize the brilliance in our instinct to move towards beauty and desirability. And I want folks to know that for some of us, it may be impossible. I know it's complicated. And I also know that though it may be a way to survive, it will never be a way to thrive, to grow the kinds of genders in the world that we need. And it is not attainable to everyone, even those who want it to be. What do we do with bodies that can't change, no matter how much we dress them up or down, no matter how much we want them to? I am talking about embracing the ugly and all it has taught us, seeing it as a magnificent piece of us, rather than something to be feared. I'm talking about bodies that get the lived experience of being ugly every day. Bodies that will never be able to squeeze themselves into what gets named as aesthetically beautiful and desirable. Those of us who are told we are undesirable and therefore disposable. I'm talking about the relentless culture that drills into us that only beautiful people are worthy, sexy, and human. That teaches us that we would want to be anything other than disabled, poor, sick, fat, dark-skinned, black, anything other than ugly. I'm questioning why in our communities is it that we feel the need to perpetually name how hot and gorgeous and fine and desirable we all are. I'm questioning why we keep trying to claw our way back into beautiful, hot, and sexy when they get used as weapons all the time against us, even in our own communities. And when they often require that we collude, whether actively or passively, with that weaponry in order to gain membership into that club. I'm questioning why, even in our own recreations of aesthetic beauty and desirability, we still reflect the cornerstones of mainstream beauty. Why we still reward people who perform aesthetic beauty and sexiness with status and social capital to use as they please, oftentimes with no accountability. I am, on a deeper level, questioning, regardless of how the external signifiers change, right? Regardless of what we decide today or tomorrow that's going to be beautiful, like, okay, this year, this is going to be marked as beautiful. This next year, this is going to be. Regardless of those external qualifiers, right? I am questioning why being understood as aesthetically beautiful is so important to us as communities who are supposedly fighting against that, I would think. To me, collective care is deeply tied to the ugly, because that is what will be waiting for us when we begin the work of truly collectively loving and caring for each other. It is what we must reveal if we are to ever truly be interdependent, and it is what we must embrace if we are ever going to be free. The famous words of James Baldwin echo in my ears over and over and over again like a steady heartbeat of truth. Love takes off the masks that we fear we cannot live without and know that we cannot live within. And the less known part of that quote continues on to say, I use the word love here not merely in the personal sense, but as a state of being or as a state of grace, not in the infantile American sense of being made happy, but in the tough and universal sense of quest and daring and growth, unquote. Because we will have conflict with each other, we will hurt each other, and we will be hurt. And yes, we will harm each other too. How could we not? These are the conditions that we're living in, and we are not free of them yet, and we won't be for some time. But, you know, I find it so amazing in our work that we have these sharp analyses on how pervasive these systems of oppression and violence are in our work, in our lives. They're part of everything that we do. They're part of the air we breathe. And yet, at the same time, we expect people to act as if they don't live in those conditions, as if they don't exist in them, as if they haven't been molded and raised in those very conditions. Conditions that tell us that violence is actually we're encouraged to use violence. It's a good way to solve our problems, right? I don't think it's as productive for us to keep trying to make safe spaces anymore, right? And trying to be, we're going to have a conference and nobody's going to do or say anything ableist. That's not going to happen. I think what's more productive and more useful for us is to spend our time putting our energy and resources into how we will respond when those things happen, because they will. Of course we are going to say and do oppressive things. Of course we are going to be violent with each other, right? It's not useful to pretend like we're not going to hurt each other, because we're basically looking away from our humanness and basically looking away and pretending away our ugliness. And I'm saying that ugliness has strength if we were to embrace that and to not shame and demonize people for that, but rather say that is if we understand violence to be systematic, then systematic means that oftentimes, while we want people to still be accountable for their own actions, that it means that they were born into a system and taught those things. Nobody was born knowing how to torture, knowing how to rape, right? Knowing how to kill somebody with a machine gun. But that is why we must start now with the work of collective care, with the work of relearning and reimagining the work of taking care of each other, really the work of love, the work of learning how to care for more than ourselves or the few people that we deem as deserving. We must commit to each other for the sake of something larger than ourselves, for liberation, for belonging, home, safety, justice, healing, and the hope that a better world is possible. Because when we leave the surface of beauty and easy, we are finally free to open ourselves up to the depth and power of our magnificence, which has always been with us. Always been there in the freak shows, staring back at the gawking crowd, in the back rooms of the brothels, in the fields, fresh with cotton, on the street corners in the middle of the night as the bombs drop, in our breaths after surviving the doctor's office, crossing the borders, in those first quiet moments of a bloody face after the attack is done. Magnificence has always been with us. The magnificence of bodies that need, that ache, that love, that take up space, that will not stop working for liberation. The magnificence of bodies that have been violated, that have barely made it through the night, that miss loved ones so deeply across oceans and borders and time. The magnificence of our longing for each other and turning towards each other despite everything we get taught. The magnificence of care. The magnificence of taking care of each other. Magnificence holds the kind of grace and compassion that we will need for true collective care. Magnificence both at once sets us free and commits us to each other. Magnificence reminds us that we are both obliged to and choose to show up for each other. You are magnificent. We are magnificent. And we can create communities that do justice to our magnificence. Communities where collective care is both a longing and a practice. And we will not be perfect, but we will commit to listen, learn, and change. To listen, learn, and change again. And to listen, learn, and change yet again. And we will commit to letting people change, even ourselves. But mostly, we will commit to being willing to try. Collective care is not easy, but I believe it's the only way forward. In all of our work, whatever that work is, the work of taking care of each other and taking care of ourselves so that we may take care of others, the work of interdependency is the task in front of us. And we have such rich histories to draw on as communities of color, queer and trans communities, poor and working class folks, immigrant communities, and so many more of us who have had to learn how to take care of each other in a world that is trying to erase us. Let us not get distracted or fooled by thinking that it will be a short road, because there is much repair and healing work to be done, even when we get to the end. Let us move towards the ugly every chance we get, not just within ourselves, but towards the people and communities that are ugly, undesirable, unwanted, disposable, hidden, criminalized, demonized, displaced. Let us learn from disabled people of color and our stories of ableism and our intimate understandings of interdependency, and let us change us. And let us let it change us. But most importantly, let us learn and remember the language of our shared magnificence and never lose it again. Thank you very much.